The Emmy is sort of interesting professionally because a lot of work came to me since that, and people call you an Emmy award-winning director as opposed to just an award-winning director. We're just finishing work on planning a music video that we're going to be shooting up in Toronto in a couple of days with the Toronto Symphony and on a piano concerto, a Roy Anderson piano concerto. And I think a lot of my work has been in music since I graduated from Cornell. I went to Yale for graduate school, and at that point I was doing a lot of photography. And one thing led to another and began to make films. Although I made a film at Cornell. Did you ever see that film? I made a film of, I can't even remember the story. It was about somebody who came into town on a train and sort of walked through the town. I don't even remember. But I remember we had a very rudimentary film program up there at one point. So I got a taste of that, and I really got more interested in doing film and photography. One of the films was on Leonard Bernstein. It's part of a series called Reflections on Famous Americans. We did Margaret Mead, Bucky Fuller, Samuel Eliot Morison, Roy Wilkins, and one of the people in that series was Bernstein, who I spent about a year with, shooting a film with him in Israel and back here in New York. And that project in 1977 sort of typecast me as somebody who was going to do some work in music, because it turned out pretty well, and people like Isaac Stern and Yo-Yo Ma and others came to me, and we began to do a lot of music projects from all through the late 70s into, through the really 80s and early 90s, I was only working on music projects. A lot of us who were in architecture think that way. You sort of imagine the whole thing, or you do preconceive it somewhere in the back of your mind. You can't close your eyes and dream it, and that's the finished thing. Maybe one day we could get wired up with electrodes and you could have it in your head and that would be it. But basically, once you see the project and what it's going to be, for me, the rest of it is almost technical. It's like you know where all the pieces fit, and you just have to go out and produce each piece and bring them back and fit them together. But I really do see the whole thing ahead of time. Over the years, my company has released a lot of videos in the home video market. You know, originally it was mostly all VHS tapes. Now we're releasing most projects on DVD, which is going to be a big help for those of us who work in music. But we did this this is a project we did with Midori, which was her Carnegie Hall debut. And it's a project on Toscanini. There's I Am Pei. This is actually a pretty good seller at PBS Video, so we're happy to have that out. And what else do we have up here? We did a film on Arthur Rubinstein, and we did Van Cliburn's whole history for A&E Biography, and Jan Pierce. And these are all the different tapes we did with Claudio Arrau. This project, because we're recording a CD at the same time as shooting the video, we need to make sure that the producer of the audio, Howard, gets all the takes and inserts he needs for the eventual editing for the CD, and I need to get everything I need for my cameras, and we only have the two sessions, limited time, at pretty big cost, like every quarter hour is $2,000 overtime. So we want to make sure we finish on time, yeah. Right, Howard? No, I think it's going to be fun, and we're very confident about it. You know, it's going to be good.
I'm Bruce Abbey, and I'm Dean of the School of Architecture at Syracuse University, and I'm finishing up my 10th year here. In the larger picture of things after graduation, I and six of my classmates went off to the Peace Corps in Tunisia, and where we continued together for many of us for another 3 years. I was first in a little town called El Kef, which is roughly translated as the Rock, on the Algerian border, and then I moved to Bizerte, where Tim and Del Mitchell were also located, and as was my future wife. After 3 years there, I returned to the United States with some great trepidation and entered graduate school at Princeton, where I stayed stayed in Princeton for 5 years, working for Michael Graves and Gettysburg or Qualls Cunningham, both on houses for the poor, houses for the rich, planning huge tracts of land in Colorado and small projects in Jersey City, New Jersey. A tremendous range of work. At that point, in 1973 and 4, I started my own practice, and given the great economic crunch of that period, started looking for a teaching position, as they might say, and headed off to the University of Virginia, where south of the Mason-Dixon line, at which point I was thoroughly raw at teaching and so on, but I had found myself in Getty's office translating Le Corbusier at night and writing my own articles, so I figured there was a certain academic bent that needed to be satisfied at this point in my life. And I stayed at the University of Virginia for 16 years, essentially helping build the School of Architecture, starting my own practice, running the school, practicing, raising a family, renovating my house, a couple houses, and otherwise doing it all in the context of that academic community. At a certain moment, you decide that it's time for a change. And when Werner Seligman retired as dean of the school here, I had been looking for a deanship at that point and had interviewed here and along with a few other places. And it seemed like it was going to be an easy and natural fit, and particularly since Werner was going to go away for 3 years to Zurich and maybe retire in Switzerland, I thought, hey, this is okay. This will be a slam dunk. And Werner returned, and we had an extraordinary, wonderful time in the time that we were together. And unfortunately, very tragically, he passed away a couple of years ago. Actually, a year ago. I apologize. A year ago, November. That was a kind of interesting closure, if you will, to the school. What I have been doing over the years has been continue to draw based on the fact that I had probably half as many credits in drawing and painting at Cornell as I did studio time, architectural studio time. So drawing has been a way for me to keep contact, and part of the exhibit at Cornell will be a series of drawings dating from 30 years ago to now. One of the extraordinary differences between our time when we graduated and the current economic market is that we have had almost 35 firms interviewing students now for the last 3 weeks, and interviews are going on all over the school today.
I got to Ithaca in a very funny way, actually, because I was going to Yale, and I wanted to go to Yale. And so I was all set and ready to go, but I had interviewed at Cornell, and just one day they called me up from the art department and asked me what I was doing, had I made up my mind, and I told them I planned to go to Yale. So they set up a meeting for me in New York, met with me, and offered me a considerable amount of money to go to Cornell rather than to go to Yale. And since I was picking up my own tab for Yale, I couldn't turn down the offer. So I went to Ithaca. Turns out they weren't that interested in my ability so much, but that I was a male. And I remember the first class, there were 26 of us, and 4 of us were male. And the rest were female. And they just desperately needed men in the art program there, because they wanted to redirect the program. So it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek when I realized what because I had gone there thinking that, geez, they really loved me, or were going to give me a special ticket or something, you know, but that was not the case. I wasn't particularly unhappy with the consequences of being there, but there was a very strong attitude of escaping that estrogen environment of the painting department. So myself and Joel Perlman and another classmate, David Barton, they had just opened up the Sculpture Foundry, so we put in to be sculpture majors and went over to the Sculpture Foundry. And there were no women in the sculpture department, at least not that first year. But it was kind of destiny. I really was galvanized by the environment and the natural setting of Ithaca. As I said, I got caught up in natural experiences and the writers, Wordsworth and Thoreau and Emerson, and Coleridge and the Cambria Lakes writers versus the American writers, the Transcendental New England writers. And that pretty much set the tone for my time in Ithaca. It was more about the nature and the way nature was viewed historically in literature, more so, much more so for me anyway, than in art. There were some great teachers there, though, that took me under their wing and who had a very nice, Victor Colby was just the most wonderful person. He's the finest person you could ever possibly have as a mentor and a guide, and he was my counselor, you know. And somewhat on the other side of him was Jack Squire, who was very different in his perspective and point of view. Jack was very focused on New York, very involved in architecture. Really struck us like, you know, like a Zen Jiroshi hit us with a bamboo stick about professionalism, professionalism, professionalism. He really wanted us to have an understanding that when we deliver a product to the marketplace, it had to have the same kind of integrity that any other product goes out professionally. That you, if you turned a piece of sculpture over or you turned a painting around, it had to be as perfect on the back as it was on the front. And that sort of training was very, very good in those formative days. I am an art writer, not to any big degree, because I still can't make money doing that. I do all right as an artist, and I sell art, and I can get along with that. I enjoy it enormously. But there are times when I just want to sit down and write and live as a writer, and I'm hoping when I have sculptors back, which is half broken, and limbs, which sleeping on floors. I lived in Boston for 2 years with no heat in the winter. So I'm carrying physical ailments and things into old age that probably are directing me towards sitting in front of a computer and writing these experiences out. So in my mind, is even though I am writing now, I'm still building toward that, and I've written 3 novels that I've never tried to get published, toward that moment when I can organize my writing, when I just can't lift another piece of sculpture or hang another painting in my life.
I feel as though I've returned to the scene of the crime, actually being here in the Yale University bookstore, because on a fateful evening in probably 1965 or so, on St. Patrick's Day, a group of us from the architecture school at Cornell University drove down here in the dark of night wearing trench coats laced with crickets, and we proceeded to entirely inundate the brand new Yale University architecture building. Some people think of me as an astrologer, some people think of me as an architect, some think of me as a writer, as an author. And having written lots of books, the way I got into it was quite unusual because I basically liked transmitting ideas visually, you know, through my art, through drawings and images, and in the early days through my architecture. In the late 70s, I began realizing more and more that I needed to really describe and express my ideas. So I had a series of paintings exhibited in London at the first Festival for Mind, Body, and Spirit in 1977. I did a series of 12 mandalas called 12 mandalas that were 12 different magical and mystical systems. And I was approached afterwards by a publisher who said, we'd like you to write a book, primarily to put your images in them, but we also want text as well. So would you like to write a book? And I said, why not? Absolutely. And this became a book that is called The Round Art and is a book that sold, I don't know, maybe 50 or 60,000 copies back in the 70s and was reprinted in the early 90s. I taught myself astrology and taught myself tarot and developed systems, interestingly enough, that for me come very directly from architecture. It was like trying to convert the proportion systems that we used to work with into a three-dimensional form. My book, Sacred Sexuality, which has a picture of Eve on the cover, originally, I proposed being an editor of the Sacred Art series, of which these two books, Sacred Architecture and Sacred Sexuality, were the first two. And I intended to actually edit these books, but the publisher turned around to me and said, can you write Sacred Sexuality? And so I joined with a friend of mine, Jane Lyle, and we wrote this book. These last two books were published in the U.S. by Barnes & Noble, and they both look like coffee table books, but anyone who knows the text of these books knows that they're not coffee table books at all. They're in fact very provocative, that they are wolves in sheep's clothing, and that's a way of doing things that I actually quite like. I would still like to design buildings. I mean, I designed a house in Denmark about 4 years ago or so, and it was a fantastic situation. I mean, I do love it. I've never not loved architecture. I'm at the moment working on a book called The Spirit of Space, which I'm hoping Penguin Putnam will do, which is a kind of alternative vision of feng shui. I've been working as a feng shui consultant for years and yet kind of object to the traditional feng shui techniques of using mirrors and flutes and so on, which makes your house end up looking like a bad Chinese restaurant.
Being Blue. Basically, I made up my name, just a stage name.
Went to Berkeley, got a master's degree at Berkeley in sculpture. Taught at Berkeley for a year. This was 66 through 69. Then we moved back to Connecticut, and then we moved to Manhattan for a year to become an art star, which was totally unsuccessful. We started out doing in 73, we started out doing a lot of solar stuff. We did the 128th and 129th solar home in the country, one with Grumman, one with Daystar, which was an Exxon thing. And we did a bunch of those all over the Northeast. Did some pre-cut stuff for a company up in Massachusetts, pre-cut post and beam. And basically kept on drawing things and building things. And when I finally stopped building things because I fell off a roof, I fell 45 feet, the design work picked up, luckily. But, and so we've done mostly lot, you know, high-end, big old houses. We've done everything. I did everything from 900 square foot three-story house in the middle of a swamp to a big goofy house that was 32,000 square feet. And when we got my son through college, opportunity with one of my clients that I worked with in Greenwich was he flew me down here to take a look at a lot on the ocean. Well, we're in Jupiter, so I live in Jupiter, but we're about half an hour north of Palm Beach, and Palm Beach is the stock pond where the money is. So it seemed like he asked me if I'd come down and watch the construction on it too. It was about 18,000 feet of house. And so I came down 2-3 weeks at a time, went back a couple weeks at a time. It got warmer and warmer here, got colder and colder in Connecticut. And so I came down here and started over down here. So I have a virtual office, and that's why this one looks so fancy. So this is where you do, so in this little place is where I can churn out night and day and churn out those big monsters.
That's a house on the ocean on Palm Beach. Jimmy Buffett's house.
Before and after shots.
You know, Cornell was a thing of learning how to solve problems. It didn't have anything to do with really what they were talking about. And if anything, when I look back on it, I was trying to figure out what they were talking about, but really what they were trying to do is teach you how to be able to go through a thought process.
the joke around this office is that if it doesn't have at least 10 bathrooms, we're not doing it. After Cornell and after Peace Corps, I was at a firm in Boston, here in Boston, for about 23 years and was a partner for about 17 years, firm of Perry Dean Rogers and Partners. And it's a firm that really has had a very mixed professional practice. I guess as time evolved and time went by, I found myself actually from some of the interior architecture work, some of the clients for whom I was doing executive offices and that kind of spaces became my clients also to do their residences because they were interested in doing something that was a little bit special and nicely designed. And probably my first client that fell into that category was a client who was very clear in their mind that they wanted a federal style house, a new house designed for them in the federal style. And they had traveled to Salem, Massachusetts, and had picked out a couple of houses they really liked and wanted one like it. That's really the kind of work we're doing. And what is most interesting, I think, about this kind of work is that, number one, people really are interested in classical styles and either ask for it very specifically for new houses or are interested in maintaining the context or the style of a house they already have. And so that, and we are interested in continuing that rather than creating a juxtaposition against that. For most people, that's much more comfortable direction. What's interesting is there are opportunities where people are able to spend money on their houses and are interested in consequently going beyond just the architecture and also are interested in introducing interesting materials. I feel a little bit like it's almost going back to the Beaux-Arts style, because we have opportunities to introduce the work of artisans of various types and take advantage of people who are really great at millwork or plaster ornamentation or metalwork, stonework, all those kinds of things that layer onto the architecture and make for some very rich product. Well, I think perhaps it takes a little while to realize, maybe not so long, to realize that even though the style is modernism, the structure is still classical, and so it really doesn't matter about the style. That the translation is really very direct. It doesn't seem inhibiting. I think the thing is learning about the classical style and classical vocabulary. When one hasn't had the opportunity to learn it in school, it just sort of takes a little longer because you mostly end up doing it by osmosis and looking at lots of examples. And I have made a real effort to travel as much as possible in Europe to look at existing examples, and that really is an enriching kind of thing that is very helpful and being able to visualize what something might be. So the challenge is to really kind of meet the needs of these clients and still have some quality in the architecture that we design. So that's what we do.
My decision to go to Cornell was not a particularly original one. My father said we could go anywhere we wanted, but he would pay our way to Cornell. I'm Brad Perkins. I am a partner in firm Perkins Eastman Architects, based in New York City. I went to Cornell like everybody else on this tape, and like many of them, I had a somewhat indirect path into my final career choice. I left the firm that my father had founded but had retired from several years before, Perkins and Will, in 1981 to set up this firm. And it was a something that I'm very glad I had the opportunity to do. I was 38, I guess, at that point. The practice has grown first slowly and then very rapidly to its current point, where we have 375 people now in New York, Pittsburgh, Stamford, Connecticut, and Toronto, Ontario. So we have focused on building real knowledge of a limited number of building types that form the core of our practice. And they are housing, but particularly with a very large emphasis on housing for special populations. We've done about 25,000 units of assisted living, retirement communities, skilled nursing, as well as another several thousand of housing for the homeless, for people with AIDS, emotionally disturbed children, recently released inmates of maximum security prisons, and other people with special housing needs. Related to that, we also have a large practice in healthcare, in education. This is one of the study models for a new campus for the University of Connecticut in Stamford. This is a photograph of the completed building that study model was used in the design process. This was published last year in Architectural Record. We have a practice in public buildings, primarily courthouses, including the Ithaca City Court. If anybody has ever had to pay a traffic fine in a new building, that's is one of our projects. And we have a large interior design group, and we do a variety of commercial projects, mostly hotels. This is Canterbury Green, project mixed use, which was really our first large building when we set up the firm. Probably my most challenging project right now is a large mixed use project in Shanghai, one of a couple of projects we're doing in China. This one, which we are doing with two other architectural firms, includes 800 units of housing and a large hotel, an office building, and a large shopping center. When I went to Cornell, I did not start in architecture. I decided to wanted some additional electives, so I started out in arts and sciences and only transferred into architecture in my sophomore year. And architectural school for me was a challenge. On my second project, the words "an immediate reevaluation of your intentions to be an architect" were written forcefully by Werner Seligman, and a few weeks later he took me aside and said that if I wasn't going to measure up to his standards, he would make sure I did not graduate.
Early on in my career at Cornell, I was getting a lot of heat from my mother, only child, widowed mother, and she was saying, "Why don't you be an architect? You can do your sculpture at night, and this way you'll make a living." And I thought, I really don't want to do my sculpture at night. I want to do it all day. But my mother kept pounding away like Smokin' Joe Fraser. And finally, I went to Jack Squire and I said, "Look, what should I do?" He said, "Well, you can be an architect, and if you're lucky, in 20 years you'll be designing your own stuff. Or you can be a sculptor and start right now, today, and be your own boss." And I saw, "Be your own boss." And that was it. So I never looked back again. And I guess I'm lucky. I'm still my own boss. This was my page in Art in America last month, showing a bronze piece made by what's called the lost styrofoam method. And I can show you how that works. This is a piece made in regular insulation, half-inch insulation, which anybody who knows about building knows about. It's really easy to work with, because all you need is a mat knife and a hot glue gun. And the nice thing about styrofoam is when you pour molten bronze on it, it just vaporizes. It just sort of goes away and it's replaced by the bronze. I mean, there's a very tight packing of sand all around it, so the bronze goes only where you want it to go. But this is how the pieces look in styrofoam, and then this is how they look when you have them in bronze. You know, I've always done, I guess what you'd call constructed sculpture, welded sculpture. I learned to weld at Ames Welding in Ithaca, in an adult education course. And the minute I saw it, I knew it was for me. The buzz, the noise, the flash, the instantness of putting steel together. So I've always been a welder. More recently, maybe in the last 20 years, I've also done a lot of bronze casting. And I've started to become more and more interested in doing large site-specific pieces, big commissions. We like to say we do desk, lobby, and airport size. Airport really turns me on. I mean, I like working in the steel yard, which I do in the summer, and the toys are bigger, the sculptures are bigger. So that's really become a big part of my work, doing big outdoor pieces. I can't imagine ever not doing sculpture. Most sculptors are found on the floor in their studio one day when they're 95. It keeps you very fit. It's very physically demanding. It's very labor intensive, and sculptors usually live a long time. So I don't really plan to do anything else except make sculpture. I also believe that my best sculpture is yet to come. So I'm looking ahead rather than behind.
The people who had been referring to us as "Hey, you," because at Cornell that's what they did. Whereas at Harvard, they called us Mr. Schwartz. I'm Warren Schwartz. I have a partner, Robert Silver. Our firm here is Schwartz Silver Architects, and we're situated in Boston. We opened the office without a job in the office, without really anything. We've had a very good practice going with Charles Hilgenhurst and Associates, but we didn't take any work from that office, nor do we intend to. And we really started from scratch. Actually, we started from credit cards. The third time at Cornell, first as a student, next as an adjunct professor, instructor in design, and then the third time really as the architect for the architecture school, where we did plans to renovate Sibley and put an addition onto the library upstairs, and to renovate and add space to Rand, and to completely renovate Jaden Hall, which is complete, and to stabilize the sculpture studio so it didn't fall into the gorge. We never were interested in developing a formulaic kind of style. And I think the work is varied, different, and I think that the projects for us are just continuing to develop in the direction which is what I would say about as random as we like it. Something stuck with me over a long period of time was that you go to Cornell, you don't get hammered into a mold. In fact, what happens is you in a sense fulfill your worst tendencies, or in a sense go in the direction that you were going before, only you just go in that direction more intensely. And so it may explain why everybody is quite different, actually. And it probably also explains the work that we do in a way, being as varied as it is, being as enjoyable as it is to do that kind of thing, and then trying to build an environment around yourself which kind of which expands rather than contracts, I guess. Went to Harvard to get a degree because I felt that I already had an architectural education from Cornell.
My work has always tried to integrate itself closely with nature. I think buildings are like armatures for things to grow on, plants, vines, things to root them to the ground, integrate them into their environment. And probably it comes from the fact that for 15 years, O'Malley and I and our family lived on a remote ranch in Northern California. And so consequently, I don't take anything for granted in the work that I do, and I try and make it as sort of earth-friendly as possible, given the context that it is, whether it's in a city or whether it's in the country or remote or right downtown. I try and bring those same ideals to what I do. And probably because of the years I spent in the East, growing up in a stone house, going to a school, prep school that was built in 1761, and spending a lot of time in New England and especially in the Berkshires, I think my buildings that I do out here really try and become as durable as possible so that they'll last a long time without a lot of maintenance and a lot of work needing to be spent to keep them looking nice. I try and I guess make buildings now that respond to the unique climate that they exist in. We live in the wine country. It's a Mediterranean climate. It's got hot, dry summers and cool, damp winters. So in those kind of climates, I naturally am drawn to Italy and France and Spain and Portugal. Homes and so forth become more successful in my eyes if they describe a private outdoor space. We're at Hammacher Schlemmer on 57th Street in New York. And there's a show called Search for Invention, and there were 350 entries, and they've winnowed it down to 18, which are here in the room, and we're amongst them.
How hot will it get? How hot can it get if you get it positioned?
It gets just below boiling.
Yeah.
How long does it take to get up to that high, though?
150 degrees, about 45 minutes.
And how long does it take to actually cook something?
It'll reach pasteurizing about 45 minutes. So 150 degrees, 45 minutes.
That's great.
190 degrees, hour and 15 minutes. 5 years ago, My wife O'Malley thought of an idea to make a lightweight solar oven to take along with us to conserve gas and maybe use to preheat water. You would put air into this thing and clip it close and orient it into the sun, and she and I surmised that it would be effective in heating water because it would create a greenhouse effect for one, and two, it would create a parabolic reflector that would shine all the sun's rays that passed by the black heated pot on the way in and reflect many of those onto the back side and the bottom side of the pot to be heated. By the time this is shown at Cornell and people become aware of this, in July we're going to be in a great deal of magazines with international subscriptions, and we're real excited about the potential for this way to use solar energy to save fuel and make camping a little bit gentler on the environment.
I am Alan Siret, Alan Daniel, L-A-L. I am my art. I am abstract, airy, amorphous, celestial, cerebral, chaotic, complicated, conceptual, cosmic. I am crumpled, delicate, diaphanous, dispersed, eccentric, enigmatic, ephemeral, ethereal, exploding. I am flexible, flimsy, formless, fragile, fragmented, funky, ghostly, graceful, hallucinatory. I am hazy, hollow, inspired, intense, irregular, knotted, lyrical, magical, mathematical. I am meditative, membranous, metaphysical, minimal, mysterious, natural, original, perishable, psychedelic. I am random, raw, scary, scattered, seminal, sensual, shapeless, soft, spiritual. I am surreal, tangled, tenuous, theoretical, transient, translucent, transparent, twisted, unorthodox. I am unfinished, unconventional, visionary. I am my art.